ultimate combination of nature, wildlife, culture, adventure, heritage, and fire. Wildlife, warning. Watching wildlife is addictive. First you start with a big five and in so many ways, then whales, penguins, meerkats, wild dogs, birds, dung beetles, etc. Responsible tourism. In South Africa, you can travel with care as you explore your protected areas, contribute to social and conservation projects, buy recycled art, and stay green. So the reality is that in terms of tourism environments, there is obviously a very close relationship. And it's not because we used to be sister departments for many, many years. But of course, we have a lot of friends, and it was wonderful for me to be in here to see colleagues that I'd worked with for many, many years, and have that kind of real sense that, for instance, we're in this together. This is from the Travel and Tourism Competitive Report from this year, from the World Economic Forum. South Africa is ranked third in the region and 64th overall, gaining 2 places since last edition. South Africa comes in high at 17th place for its natural resources. This is our tourism product, our natural resources. And 58th for its cultural resources, based on its many World Heritage Sites, its rich fauna, its creative industries, and so on and so forth. So the title in the original program was Balancing Tourism Development and Environmental Management. This is not a balance. This is a partnership. This is not a competition. The one is a dependency on the other. So I would rather say that we're talking about enhancing tourism development through effective environmental management. Basically protecting the goose that lays the golden eggs. If we don't have the golden eggs, we don't have the goose. So let's look at the other section about how environmental impact management is helping to assist in this area. In 2010, we did a review of the environmental impact management regime, and we looked at, amongst others, the whole purpose of facilitating tourism development and, importantly, protecting, maintaining, and enhancing the key tourism offering product and or experience, which is South Africa's natural beauty and our natural environment. Basically, what we have is a situation where tourism facilities outside of protected areas are not significantly affected by environmental impact regulations, unless they are exceptionally large. And these are normally things like golf estates and what have you, and it's normally triggered by very large conversions of land or large amounts of water being used and so on and so forth. However, we created a thing called Listing Notice 3, which was created specifically to look at environmental impacts of developments in protected areas. And those are all subject to environmental impact assessments, and in order to meet those objectives of facilitating tourism development, and protecting, maintaining, and enhancing the key tourism offering. So protected areas to which Listing Notice 3 applies are basically all the protected areas under the National Environmental Management Protected Areas Act, including protected areas, special nature reserves, national parks, provincial parks, World Heritage Sites, and so on and so forth. Under Listing Notice 3, in respect of tourism facilities, the overall aim is of protection and maintaining of the very basis of their tourism potential. That's what this is all about. So the activities listed in Notice 3 ensure, among other things, that, for instance, that we have the minimum disruption of the area of natural environment in terms of its disturbance. The idea that, for instance, you try and market Table Mountain by moving Table Mountain, and I heard the point that we've moved mountains, and hopefully we don't. The importance of them is that they are there, and that we preserve and protect them, and we maintain and enhance their value. That's the important aspect of this stuff. That natural vegetation and indigenous vegetation is protected where we need to. Roads are not unnecessarily wide. In many of these sort of instances, we don't need highways through parks. But, DJ, I take your point. We need roads in the park. They don't have to be highways. That we mitigate the visual impacts. I mean, if people come for the visual impact of God's window by putting a lodge right in God's window, not only is that an assault to God, but it's also an assault to the tourists themselves. That tourist numbers themselves are taken into account to maximize the tourism experience and the benefits of tourism within the carrying capacity of particular areas. There have been huge concerns in many African parks that people are now watching game in convoys. Basically, so many tourists are allowed into the park that the entire essence of a natural environmental experience is lost completely. And so we have to have basically a balance between exactly how we manage these facilities, how we use our resources to the best advantage. So the activities listed in Notice 3 also go hand in hand with the approved management plan for protected areas, where tourism activities are fully aligned with conservation activities to maximize the quality and benefits of both activities. That's the intention. So the typical activities, and I don't want to bore you with this kind of detail, but just to give you a sense of what are the activities within protected areas that trigger basic assessments. And I must once again just say that these are basic assessments. It's not the full environmental impact assessment process. But basically, if there is a requirement for 250 cubic meters of water, if there are masts that are higher than 15 meters, if there are cable cars or funiculars that could actually make an impact on things, if there's storage of dangerous goods, if you're clearing over 300 square meters of vegetation, if 75% of that vegetation is indigenous vegetation, if your jetties and boardwalks exceed 10 square meters, these trigger an assessment. But apart from the environmental management regime, which is very much a command and control regime, there are also some facilitatory interventions as well. And typically, for example, if an environmental management framework is developed around a natural area, a park, a World Heritage Site, and in that buffer zone around the park, to try and maintain the character, there is a strong pressure for ecotourism or those kind of activities, then those activities that would trigger an environmental impact assessment can easily be delisted. So there is no requirement for an EIA. Then furthermore, in terms of government-supported support to small and medium enterprise tourism development initiatives, the department offers pro bono support for the EIA work. So the idea is that you don't take government grant and then use a government grant to do an environmental impact assessment. You use the government grant to build the facility, and that we will provide the expertise to make sure that the facility is sustainable. So that's all the positive side, but of course there's an element to tourism as well that also has an environmental impact. And the one that I'm just going to, there are many of them, but the one that's quite significant and perhaps a threat that should be spoken about, I think, Chair, is the whole aspect of South Africa in terms of our international tourism is that South Africa is a long-haul destination. And from the climate change policy, it's quite clear that tourism itself is an industry and a sector that could be impacted by things like shifts in consumer preferences and shifts in investor priorities. We're a long-haul destination. So in other words, your carbon footprint, if you come to South Africa, is big. And if people sort of say we must reduce our carbon because it's changing the planet and it's changing the climate, then perhaps South Africa is not the best place to visit. And this is something we must understand and realize. And we need to mitigate it in some way. We need to try and convince people that even though we're a long-haul destination, that our tourism product actually is beneficial to the planet. That's what we have to do. Just to give you an indication of exactly what that carbon footprint is, this is the carbon footprint for the 2010 World Cup. And as you can see, 67% of our emissions for the World Cup was purely on international transport. The actual building of the stadium and the actual stadium energy use was 0% compared to the big picture. So you can see what the actual carbon footprint here is. It's not on the buildings and the structures, but it's things on accommodation energy and traveling to South Africa. So it's an area that is vulnerable to climate change response. But there have been very, very good moves to actually start looking at changing that process and changing that picture. For instance, during the World Cup, we knew we have a high carbon footprint. There was a whole movement to start looking at greening our establishments, and the department held a series of workshops together with our British counterparts, and we basically assisted over 100 accommodation facilities in 3 locations around the country to look at their environmental management practices, which of course was also good business. If they reduce their energy, reduce their water consumption, of course their costs are reduced, but they also have a green image. So it's a win-win situation. But of course it needs training. In the preparation for the climate change COP17 as well, the same situation is happening, and this we've talked about municipalities, and here's a municipality that was very, very proactive hosting this particular event. They sort of said that less than 5% of our 5,000 accommodation facilities actually have any form of green grading, and so therefore we need to actually intervene. If we've got a whole bunch of greeny beanies coming to our country. They're going to look for greeny beanie accommodation. And so there was a whole outreach process of actually looking at greening the accommodation facilities in Durban, which was highly successful. And to a large extent, took stuff from the department that was pushed by the Department of Tourism through SABS, National Minimum Standards for Responsible Tourism, and actually started making these real at the municipal level. So the kind of programs they looked at was responsible accommodation forums, using the National Minimum Standards for Responsible Tourism and bringing that to the attention of people, looking at a self-assessment tool so that accommodation facilities could assess themselves to see where they could change things, and then looking at a visitor's charter as well that they were responsible for visiting. So in conclusion, Chair, balancing tourism development and environmental management implies a trade-off between tourism and environment, when in fact the relationship is a dependency, not a competition. On the one hand, our tourism very largely, depends on the quality and beauty of our natural environment. On the other hand as well, the quality of and beauty of our natural environment is also valued by the economic value of the tourism that it brings. This is a partnership. And so the sustainability of our tourism depends largely on the sustained quality of our key tourism product, our beautiful natural heritage. And that's where I'll stop. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Mr. Luki. Yes, we are a long-haul destination. So we need to plant more trees, and we need to use more green energy in order to mitigate climate change and perhaps compensate so as to continue to promote our destination as an environmentally friendly destination at the end of the day, because we plant trees and because we use much more green energy perhaps. Over to you, Mr. Shah.
Thank you, Chair. I was actually quite shocked to see our carbon footprint for the 2010, 67%. I'm really shocked. But I guess the challenge, Chair, and I don't know, I don't have an answer. There are two questions here. Is how do we practice tourism in a responsible and environmentally sustainable manner? Is it simply a question of ensuring that all our development and management strategies are implemented in a way that we reduce or keep our ecological footprint as minimum or as soft as possible? How do you balance that with achieving the NTSS targets and job creation and all of that? The other question is that the reality is that we are a long-haul destination. There's no two ways about that. The concern, Chairperson, is what if tomorrow there is a new regime on carbon emissions related to air travel? Okay? Which obviously is going to trickle down effect and impact on the cost of travel. Now how is that going to affect, in spite of our rigorous, vigorous marketing and all of that, at the end of the day it's a question of affordability. And then again, the more people become aware of environmental issues and their role in their carbon footprint, their own carbon footprint in the system, they might tend to not travel as far as South Africa. So how is that going to impact on us? It's just a question, Chair. I don't know who's going to answer it, but just thinking aloud.
Mr. Luki, you mentioned that pro bono environmental impact assessments were available and that they've been planned for. Would this extend to 4x4 trails and tracks which have taken a serious back seat in development since the National Off-Road Work Group has been put in place and the regulation that Mr. van Schalkwyk basically enforced when he closed off the beaches? Would there be a bit of a respite here so that we could perhaps see a growth in that area of tourism again, as it does fall into the rural tourism development
sphere.
Before by force. Over to you, Mr. Lukey.
I'm not sure how many poor people actually own 4x4. And I don't know how many poor people can actually run 4x4. But I'll ask that question immediately. No, there's no respite. The pro bono work is in terms of actual tourism development by small and medium enterprises that is looking at, I mean, if it involves, for instance, the development of a trail, for example, a 4x4 trail, and it is a government-supported project, and then, yes, that's absolutely possible. But in terms of just general support, that is not going to happen. Chair, a lot of the comments are just perfectly sound, important comments, and I think I can attempt to answer some, or at least provide an opinion on some. The one thing, and you talked about the use of acronyms, and the one thing around SIPs, for example, the strategic integrated program. The one that we're actually in the process of working on at the moment is a new SIP, SIP 19, which is an environmental SIP. And one of them is looking at the whole aspect around the restoration of ecological infrastructure for water security, actually. But the nice thing about this sort of work is that it's, whereas SIP 18 is what we call the taps and toilets SIP, the water supply, the water purification, and so on and so forth. This looks above that, about how the water goes into the dam to stop the erosion and what have you. And the nice thing about that particular type of work, which of course has a huge implication for tourism, because you're basically looking at the headland, the headwaters, that 8% of the South African land that is responsible for 50% of our water runoff, that basically is in the rural areas, where people who are completely poor don't get a single cent for actually protecting our water resources. There's a real chance here that, for instance, we can start thinking like restoring wetlands and things like that have huge tourist potential. And the nice thing about that is that you cannot restore a wetland with a bulldozer. You have to restore a wetland with people. So there's a real chance that if by building up our tourism product, by actually restoring our natural environment, we can actually start looking at the creation of jobs in specifically areas where we have many unskilled or semi-skilled people that can actually do an honest day's work, that can do really, really good work, and work that has a very, very high level of dignity, because what you're doing is you're basically replanting the planet. So in terms of the whole aspect of green tourism, there is a strong element where if we combine our tourism with the restoration of our natural environment, which we have to start looking at, then there is a strong opportunity for increased job creation, and especially in public works programs, looking at exactly that. And I put it to you, Honourable Member, that in terms of this particular SIP, for example, do you know that New York does not filter its water? All it does is invest in its watershed, in the natural ecosystem above one of the largest cities in the world that does not filter its water. It just invests in the natural environment above the city. And we can learn a lesson from that, and hopefully we will. And within that, suddenly, this watershed, which is now providing this fantastic service to the people of New York, is also a fantastic tourist attraction, because the natural environment then becomes a park. So there's some very, very interesting new ideas and new processes here, where there's a real chance of complete synergy, I think, between tourism and environment once again. In terms of the aspect of a new regime, I mean, we mustn't hide our head in the sand here. This is quite possible that consumers, by their very nature, tend to be fickle. You know, there's sometimes no understanding why, for instance, 1 week a restaurant is hugely fashionable, and then 3 weeks later it's closed. And the same applies in this sort of situation, that if people think, hang on a second, this destination is far too far away, and that our carbon footprint is causing floods in our own hometown, we cannot go there in good conscience. We have to provide a means, and I believe that there is a means, through offsetting, by saying, if you come to South Africa, we can allow you to offset your carbon emissions by investment in clean energy in South Africa. So actually coming to South Africa is a mitigation effort in itself. And that's what you want. You actually want to have the situation where people sort of say, no, it's not a bad thing for me to travel there, but because if I travel there, I'll pay a certain amount of money, and there will be a real environmental benefit to my travelling. So in other words, I'm actually contributing to a sustainable solution. And that must be the way we look at this, I think. And we must be proactive about these sort of situations, start to look at these things. In terms of carbon offsets, I'm afraid South African Airways was one of the last airlines to even start thinking about carbon offsetting. All the other airlines travelling to South Africa already had offset regimes. But we have to start thinking about these because people are fickle. The lions will remain the same, but suddenly someone will say, the carbon miles are just too high.
Mr. Farai, then Mr. Shah, then Ambassador.
Thank you, Chairperson, and welcome to the presentation. I just wanted to find out, in terms of environmental affairs vis-a-vis to domestic tourism, I'll always make an example of my province, Free State, because I'm from the Free State. If you go to the town called Sasolburg and leave Sasolburg, go to Zamdela. Because if you go to Zamdela, you pass the industry where there's a lot of pollution there. And there's this notion from the people of Zamdela that it's better to stay in Zamdela for the whole day, because if you can go out to go maybe to another area where this is not the building, you get sick because of that pollution. That area in terms of tourism is going to be affected, or it's affected, because I, for one, I think I'm not going to stay in a day right in Zamdela. It says there's a huge problem in terms of domestic tourism for people of South Africa to go to that particular area. How do the government maybe try to intervene? But I'm sure it's not only that. You go to a number of areas in the municipality, you see the lack of the sewer system, and it's affecting mostly. It's something maybe resistant. You see the black areas, and it's still there. And it will live there for a lot of days or months. How do the Department of Environmental Affairs assist the issue of domestic tourism? We have to go to different areas to promote domestic tourism. Thank you, Chair.
Mr. Shah?
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to respond, perhaps maybe the department might want to consider what I'm saying. The first comment I want to make is the irony of tourism sometimes. We went to Pongola, Chair, on our oversight visit. You remember there was that wonderful dam on the banks of which was located this beautiful hotel where we stayed. That community doesn't have access to that water. And then that's the irony. This is the reality. You remember that. So I just wanted to make that point, that further elaborates. I mean, that community is busy protecting our ecology, and they don't have the water. But having said that, to mitigate against the reduction in the foreseeable future, if at all, due to carbon emissions whatsoever, if we look at our international spend, tourist spend versus domestic tourist spend, I think our last stats show us that our local domestic spend was much more than the international spend. Now, would it not make more sense then, and I don't know what South African tourism will think about this day here, to invest, or rather anchor our tourism sector industry to domestic tourism and spend more on domestic tourism and education around tourism, perhaps, you know, include it in our educational curriculum designs in schools and create awareness around the beauty of our country and get more people to travel locally from a small age and then introduce it as a specialist subject perhaps at higher level and at tertiary level, and to create this regional hype, you know, about tourism. Maybe we can look at, you know, regional tourism, it's closer to home, and perhaps spend more of our resources and energy on domestic tourism. And I mean, international tourism is also sometimes very, very unpredictable. There are huge issues that sometimes affect the arrivals, conflicts, slowdown in the economy, global economy, all of these things. And that would, in many ways, mitigate against the very challenge that we're talking about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Macumele.
Chairperson, it's scary what I heard here, that because we are a long-haul destination, we may eventually be shunned by the whole world and not get tourists because of the carbon footprint related to that. Some time ago, the Minister made a presentation in Cabinet. And that presentation the Minister made, it actually showed the number of planes over Europe. Europe is lit by planes. You actually see more planes than stars if you look at the number of planes that are moving around Europe compared to what comes to the continent. Now, currently, you have about 26,000 commercial planes that are flying around the world. You have 7,000 aviation companies. Now, the projection by all key role players in the aviation industry is that between now and 2020, you are going to have double the number of commercial planes that are flying around the world. Now, if we were not to benefit out of this boom, we're going to have a serious challenge, because since the 12th century, during the Zhou monarchy, what has been developing, what has been driving development was transport. Communication came later. That's what makes people to evolve. Now, if we are going to be isolated from the rest of the world, it's going to be a serious disaster. If you look at our own products that we move within the shortest space of time around the world, it will be a serious disaster to us in terms of moving products, not only on the commercial planes, but also the cargo side. The cargo side currently, it's a $5 trillion rand business, $5 trillion business, not rand, because it moves products around the world within a short notice. All of us, I think we've done that. I've ordered books at Amazon 3 days later. I have them here. They're shipped from the most remote area in Chicago. And I'll get them within 3 days, these books here. But they're all moved by aviation. What are we saying in terms of the long term? The aviation industry, if you look at all the role players, and I'm talking those who are manufacturing engines and so on, I hope Sean is still here. They will tell you about the emission that is caused by the modern jet. All the role players, the Boeing company, Airbus, Rolls-Royce, and General Electric, and everyone else is involved in the manufacturing of engines and planes, they're spending a lot of money in terms of coming up with modern engines that would allow long distance. I mean, currently, the longest that most of these planes can make is 15,000 kilometers, and if you look at the last few years, planes did not have that kind of range. But they are improving the engine capacity and the emission level to reduce that by the required percentages. I forget, I think 0.2 or 2.0 that they're trying to cut down emissions to make them more sustainable. I think there's an understanding within the aviation industry in terms of the carbon footprint and the level of technology that is emerging to develop these lighter planes that consume less So let's benefit from this science that it's really changing the manner in which we move around the world. It will be unfortunate if we were to appear to be ashamed and begging and allow people to dictate that people should not visit here. And yet the movement of planes within the European airspace is basically scary. I ask myself, how do they do the air control around the area? Because if you look at the number of planes, they are more than the skies if you look at the slides. What are we saying about our own development and our own interconnectivity with the rest of the world if we accept the fact that because we are a long haul, we must be cut out of the world and therefore isolated, I don't know for how long, but isolated and eventually left to perish on our own without interacting with the rest of the world. It would be a bit of a disaster in my own view, but technology now allows better interaction, and I think we should all of us insist on this technology, benefiting out of this technology as a long-haul destination. Not only in terms of passenger movement, also in terms of cargo movement. We have this produce that we are moving around the world. We produce the best citrus fruits around here that we must ship within a short space of time. It's unlike in the old days, if we were to put them in the ocean to move the citrus fruits to where they are supposed to be, it will take years, they'll be rotten by the time they arrive there. But we are being allowed to benefit from this development. It's really fundamental and crucial for our own development. Those who develop and they emit it more than anyone else, they are now benefiting from the boom. So there is this differentiated but equal approach that we need to deal with, and looking at our own developmental needs. And I think developed countries should continue to really support us, and they must take more in terms of their own emission issues and spend more in terms of mitigating that. It will be unfortunate. And I must say, and I'm sorry, I have no intention to offend anyone, but you get a lot of European environmentalists who literally do not look at their own development. If it was according to them, we must go to Stone Age and let them keep on developing at their own expense. We shouldn't do anything. We can't even build a road infrastructure. We can't build any railway. And actually, if you look at where they are now, they've benefited at our own expense. So those are things that we need to manage at the strategic level, at policy level, as we move forward, or else we are doomed to be isolated from the rest of the world. Now is a big challenge. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, that's why we've got to keep talking dialogue before they run out. Over to you, Mr. Luki.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be brief. I mean, because all the statements are, of course, important and correct. I think, but in terms of some, I'll try to work through the questions as they go. I mean, in terms of some places, we must understand what tourism potential is. And I'm afraid I have a very close relation to Zamdela. I was an activist in Zamdela against air pollution for many, many years. Zamdela is never going to be a tourist attraction unless you like that sort of stuff. I mean, and if you like that sort of stuff, then you won't mind being poisoned, because Zamdela is a poisonous atmosphere, and it's an awful situation. It's a completely unacceptable situation, but it's not, and it will never be, certainly in our lifetime, a tourist destination. There may be cultural tourism in terms of Zamdela, and there probably is very, very important cultural tourism. And that needs to be developed. But the reality is that eventually you have to kind of make a real decision about, for instance, what is the most important resource in this area, what is the most important source of employment, and what have you. And there is some sacrifice. I'm afraid Sasselburg is not a pretty place. And even though Sassel put a whole bunch of zebra around their plant and what have you, it's still not a tourist attraction. In terms of the irony. The irony goes even further in terms of natural environment. Is that often the place that we see as being important natural environment, the people that have made it that important natural environment, the custodians of it for centuries, are the first people that have moved off it, and then we put a whole bunch of professionals to look after it, which is bizarre. I mean, so within that sort of situation, the irony of that is just is to me is frightening and disturbing. But you're absolutely correct. That whole sort of situation that, for instance, that the payment for ecosystem services, the people that have been the custodians of this real beauty in these natural areas, they should be paid for those services. They have to be paid for it in a way. It's as if we're relying, for instance, on our water from the poorest of the poor and expecting them to keep on providing with no payment whatsoever. And we talk about service delivery payments. It's often in the wrong direction. We're not paying the people that are actually looking after a lot of this stuff. The aspect of, and I'm not going to speak about tourism policy, I'm certainly not in a place to talk about that, but I mean, in terms of the international tourism, the aspects of foreign currency and our balance of payments have a huge role to play here, in terms of its addition to the GDP and that sort of stuff. I mean, I think it's an important aspect, so we can't deny the one or just concentrate on the other, just have the internal stuff. We have to, I think, rely quite heavily on the international stuff as well to bring in the foreign currency. In terms of the climate change impacts, I'm not going to talk about that for the simple reason I'm just raising a risk. And the risk is a real risk. I mean, for instance, with the melting of the ice caps and the opening of the Northern Passage, we are going to see less ships coming around the Cape. This is a reality. This is not a policy issue. This is a personal choice issue. So even though we can sort of say, but you've got millions of planes flying over Europe, that's not an issue for the person who makes the personal choice of whether to come to South Africa or not. The personal choice is not about the justice of the issue, or whether they are actually living a completely unsustainable lifestyle, as they are, and as we know. It comes down to a sort of situation of marketing. We have to convince the person, the greeny beanie, as you say, that coming here is a good idea. And so it's not a policy issue. And because the UK is not going to say, no one is allowed to travel to South Africa because of travel miles anymore. People will make their own personal choices around that. And I think to deny that we need to see this as at least a potential risk would be denialism, to be honest. We have to take this into account. But DG, you're absolutely correct. I mean, the actual technology stuff that is happening is really, really impressive. The whole aspect of Virgin Atlantic is starting to look at biofuels as the sustainable fuel for this, so that means that they have no carbon footprint. Those kind of issues are things that we must keep our finger on the button of completely. And that's where I'll stop. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much. Yeah, in fact, with this debate, I think this debate begins to emphasize that we've got to employ much more resources and capacities into our domestic and regional tourism. Whilst this debate goes on, in case then Mother Luck turns the other way, then perhaps we've got something to fall back to. But it also says we've got to mitigate the mitigation against climate change has got to be a conscious effort from our side as South Africans, and in order to be in a position to further market our destination, should that put forward by Mr. Logi comes into reality. We've got to provide for every eventuality, starting from consciously making South Africa a greener place by making sure that we mitigate against climate change. If you go to a country like China, in a freeway, you find that on the islands between the opposing carriageways, the other one moving this side, the other one moving the other way, there are a lot of trees on the island, and then there are rows of trees on each side of the road. But I do not know whether we have enough water to do that in South Africa. That's another question for another day. But we have come to the stage where now we've got to summarize and then we have to make recommendations, and then make an outline as to what is going to happen tomorrow morning. Over to you, Jerry, and the staff.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm not sure in the interest of time, because we have some slides that capture the summary for the day, if maybe we can do that, or we can just highlight what happened in that project.
I think it's better to highlight that, so that when we go to commissions tomorrow, if perhaps there is a vehement rejection of some of the recommendations of what is the position, then it can be corrected then.
Thank you. I won't project, but I'll quickly just go through what we captured as some of the recommendations that we've form crafting of the recommendations by end of business day tomorrow. There was an expressed need to invest in both mature and emerging markets, also issue of more resources that need to be spent on domestic tourism. I think it occurs with what also was discussed just now with regard to tourism and environmental nexus. And also the need for municipalities to conduct audit of their tourism assets so that to understand what each province has to offer. With regard to NDP, I'll just summarize by saying there is a need to understand where different stakeholders converge in terms of tourism so that we can create more synergies to eliminate inefficiencies. Also, there was a recommendation that we need to address both the spatial and land issues that impact on tourism, particularly at a local level, with regard to arts and culture. A heritage levy was mooted that can be collected at all cultural heritage sites, which can be similar to the tourism levy, and also a joint marketing for cultural offerings so that we leverage on tourism and cultural assets of our country. The potential of SIPs for tourism development needs to be reported within the PICC information related to tourism stakeholders. And there was also a discussion around a need for joint planning in a national strategy and policy development between tourism, arts and culture, and Department of Cooperative Governance. It was mainly between tourism and cooperative governance, but given the discussions earlier with arts and culture, we just included all those separate departments together there. Also, the issue of development of local tourism sector strategies at local level is needed to stimulate tourism development. So that is regard with assistance that can be given to municipalities in terms of developing sector strategies. There was also a recommendation to look at a joint implementation of South African Tourism Planning Toolkit for local government, that is between NDT and the COC. Also, NDT to consider incentive-based tourism funding to stimulate tourism development at local level, and need for partnership with SALCA in training for municipal staff, provincial and national government to make tourism funding available to local government. Municipalities need to create a conducive environment for tourism, and also a recommendation around NDT to assist municipalities in making a solid case for the importance of tourism. That was around the whole issue of the political setup and capacity at a local level. This one, I think, was, I'm not saying it was overemphasized, but it's very important, the dire need to look at institutional capacity building for municipal LED and tourism officials. So there was a long discussion around that. Also, a recommendation that
maybe we need to investigate the, what I call the development agency approach in assisting struggling municipalities in areas where it's been noticed that some municipalities conduct their tourism function through these development agencies. And also, there was a recommendation where there needs to be more engagement with Department of Water and Environmental Affairs to fully understand the pro bono EIA assistance provided for tourism SMMEs, because it was just mentioned, but I think there needs to be more engagement in that regard. Also, to encourage and promote greening of South African tourism industry to protect the environment and attract the green tourists, investigating building into travel arrangements, some carbon offset programs, SAT to think about encouraging tourism growth on domestic tourism versus international tourism, and also an extensive debate around the carbon footprint. So the recommendation here is for Parliament to look into differentiated but equal development in terms of restrictions posed by carbon footprint regime, particularly with the EU. So those are the recommendations in terms of all the presentations that were conducted today. In terms of what will be happening tomorrow, we will have tea at 8:30 as today, and our proceedings will commence at 9:00. In our program, you will indicate it is indicated in each session. The main hall will be a session that will be held here. So those delegates of the conference who would like to attend a session on unlocking barriers for tourism in terms of airlift will be here. Then you will have others as indicated in the program. Those two venues are where we had tea today, just close to where we had tea. The first one, there is a ramp as you, where we had tea, there is a ramp down there, there is a room. If you proceed down the corridor, there is another room just here. So it's not outside, it's just here. So after tea, you just arrange yourself as to where your interest is. Then it will be here in these two rooms where we had tea, Chairperson. I think that will be all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kuzma. We are not going to discuss the merits of the recommendations. We shall save that for tomorrow, last item tomorrow. So we're just flagging what we had for your consideration and perhaps input in order to correct that. And then I would like to say thank you very much for everyone who participated today and for the great inputs that we received, and we wish you all the luck as we break down, and we shall be meeting tomorrow at 8:30. I thank you very much. Let us adjourn.
If you might have one word of you.